You know how important it is to ensure that your supplements are genuine, safe, and effective. That's why I partnered with Fullscript, an online dispensing platform that only offers curated professional-grade brands I know and trust, the very same supplements that I prescribe to my patients and take myself. Never counterfeit or expired, always stored and shipped correctly. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com to start your free Fullscript account. Buying through Fullscript offers fast shipping, optional refill reminders, a mobile-friendly site. It's safe, secure, and HIPAA-compliant and offers world-class support. Fullscript also gives you access to my custom-targeted supplement protocols that combine the products that I recommend to address specific needs, heart health, immune support, and much more. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com to sign up for your free Fullscript account. You'll get access to the supplements and features you need to help you achieve your wellness goals. That's DearHoffmanStore.com. DearHoffmanStore.com. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Carolyn is president of Impact Health Media. She is a one-person, prolific media and content creator on behalf of natural medicine. She's the founder of the Natural Medicine Journal. She hosts the Natural Medicine Podcast. And she also is co-host of Five to Thrive Live with one of my favorite people in the integrative medicine movement, integrative oncologist, who's a good colleague of mine. So she's been writing and publishing integrative health information since 1992. She's also co-author of several books and booklets on a variety of holistic health topics. So, great stuff. We talked a little bit about the study on omega-3 fatty acids in the brain, slowing cognitive decline. The co-host of Five to Thrive Live is Lise Alschuler, integrative oncologist. And so, you've also done several things on the theme of brain health. You shared with me before we jumped on the air together that an interest of yours has been integrative ways of slowing cognitive decline. So what have you been finding out lately?
Well, I'm just fascinated with the gut-brain axis. And so earlier we were talking about how do I get my ideas? And I read this study about how the gut-brain axis can help identify how resilient a person can be. Now that's kind of fascinating, right? So I reached out to the lead author of this study. And, you know, we were also talking earlier, 5 years ago, if I would reach out to such a talented neuroscientist and say, hey, I want to interview you for the Natural Medicine Journal, they may not even call me back. Yep. But today, they're excited to be interviewed.
Great.
And this is a UCL neuroscientist. She also
They may not have wanted to be stigmatized by association with something
exactly
like natural medicine, but now it's become mainstream. So they feel like, okay, this is good.
Oh, totally. It happens all the time. Researchers will get back to me and I set it up. And this was a UCLA neuroscientist, Dr. Arpana Church. She also happens to be a microbiome expert.
Oh, wow.
So who perfect to talk about this gut-brain connection as it relates to resilience, which I had just finished an article for Psychology Today on how to cultivate resilience in our life. This resonated with me big time. So
can you just provide us with like a concise definition of resilience? Are we talking about overall resilience? Are we talking about resilience to infectious diseases or how broad a concept is this?
Yeah, well, this is more narrow because this, both my Psychology Today and Dr. Church's work is resilience as it relates to stress.
Oh, okay.
How resilient are we when it comes to, getting over stressful events? And how resilient are we in terms of reducing our risk of depression and anxiety as it relates to stress? Okay. And that was my Psychology Today column. My Psychology Today column is called The Healing Factor. So I called up Dr. Church and she's like, yeah, I'm in. And the first point that Dr. Church made, which I was so glad that she made this point, because she was saying her research regarding the gut-brain axis, but I think we can apply this to the gut-liver, the gut-skin, the gut-immune, whatever we're Absolutely. Talking about. Yeah. I recently did an article on the gut-eye axis, which I found Wow. fascinating. Yeah, that was pretty cool. So anyway, she said straight away, she's like, the reason she loves this, doing this work, is because it shifts her focus to more prevention than treatment. Mm-hmm. So if we can identify issues and then we can go in and help heal the gut, and it will help other things, that's a very integrative, preventive, wonderful focus. So she and her colleagues...
And by the way, this almost goes back to the very roots of naturopathic medicine.
Absolutely.
And ancient roots, because you know the route to overall health is digestion and proper assimilation. And then there's this whole notion of the... beneficial bacteria that was introduced, over a century ago, and all the stuff that was actually forgotten for a while and submerged by high tech medicine is now coming back in full force.
Yeah, I mean, when I first started 30 years ago, the big catchphrase was "Death begins in the colon." Mm. And, that was a mantra, you got to be looking at the gut. And that was 30 years ago. So maybe that's why I'm drawn to this research so much.
That sounds like a pamphlet in a health food store, which was a little bit a little weird then.
It was, yeah.
But now it's, part of the subject of academic papers.
It is. Yeah. Yeah. So her and her colleagues wanted to find out if there's a difference in the microbiome of resilient people. And so what they did, and they, as I said, they were looking at resilient people as it relates to coping mechanisms. Mm-hmm. So what they did was they had the participants fill out a resilience questionnaire. Mm-hmm. They did MRI brain scans. Of course, she's a neuroscientist. And then they took stool samples to look at the microbiome participants. So what they found was that the highly resilient individuals, that their brain imaging showed that they were able to pump the brakes, and these are her words, pump the brakes when they were in these heightened stressful situations. And they were able to pump the brakes much better than the individuals who were less resilient. But what they found was that the more resilient people also had less intestinal permeability, less dysbiosis, less leaky gut. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Than the resilient people. That's pretty cool stuff.
So did they do like functional MRI and then expose them to some stressful situation and see how the brain image showed a pattern of optimal response versus an adverse response, like a kind of a emotional meltdown kind of response?
Yeah, exactly.
I guess they probably used technology to see how the brain looked under those circumstances, not just because a self-described, questionnaire is like, yeah, I'm super resilient, but maybe I'm just making it up.
Yeah, exactly. So in order to determine who would be in which category, that's where the questionnaire came in. I can't remember the type of resilient questionnaire, but it's specific to stress resilience. So that's how they were able to divide them. But then the MRI and then the stool samples is what determine, the correlation between the more resilient people and the people with a healthy gut, and the less resilient people and the people who didn't have the healthy gut. Now, the other interesting thing is they also did, a clinical analysis. Are you depressed, anxiety, those types of things. What they also found was that the people who had the healthy gut and were more resilient also didn't have depression and anxiety, whereas the people who had the leaky gut and were not resilient also tended to have more risk of depression and anxiety. But the cool thing was when we were talking, she started to talk about how the resilient people also had more mindfulness. They were kind, they were compassionate. Mm-hmm. And
less reactive, perhaps. Yeah.
Yeah. And I could almost hear, because, you know, this is an audio interview, but I could almost hear her excitement, like, wow, what if we could determine that a healthy gut makes people more kind and compassionate? So not only is your healthy gut going to make you more resilient to stress, you're also going to be more compassionate to others, and you're going to be kinder to others. And it's kind of a cool thing when you hear the excitement in this neuroscientist microbiome expert who's looking at things like kindness and compassion and resilience. You know, they're not looking at, oh, is my patient going to develop brain cancer? You know, they're looking at these things, these characteristics that we as humans want, not only for ourselves, but for others. So she was a really great interview for sure.
So it opens up the possibility that maybe in the field of criminology, we should be analyzing the stool samples of violent and aggressive criminals, and then maybe undertaking an experimental modification through diet and so-called psychobiotics, probiotics that may have mood altering effects or beneficial effects on the balance in the gut. Yeah. We could go on and on about this.
Oh yeah. And I asked her, about probiotics because I was thinking, like, is she like one of these integrative, she says she's integrative, but now all of a sudden she wants to give the person a drug. And she was like, absolutely. When it comes to changing the environment of the microbiome, probiotics, diet, lifestyle, mindfulness, all of these things and all of these ways to ensure that the gut is healthy and that we're not getting leaky gut. This is what we need to focus on in order to make this happen. So yes, definitely that was certainly a memorable interview. I think it just came out at naturalmedicinejournal.com. That's a good one. And there was another one that I just recently did also on the brain, and this was with a really, really accomplished neuro-oncologist, a physician scientist. Her name is Dr. Soma Sengupta. She also went through the integrative medical program. But I mean, this is a researcher who's highly accomplished. I can't remember which organization she's with right off the top of my head, but it's one of the big ones.
That's the program established by Andrew Weil at the University of Arizona. So it's under his aegis. But now Lise Alschuler is very instrumental in crafting that curriculum.
Right. So this is a PhD neuro-oncologist, MD, you know, I mean, she's just highly accomplished, went through the integrative fellowship program. And we talked about brain cancer and glioblastoma, really, really difficult to treat. And, you know, of course she was technical and way over my pay grade on many issues. But she started to talk about music therapy and art therapy as it relates to brain cancer treatment. And she's doing studies. She developed an app and she's doing studies to see how music and art therapy can help with the treatment of these really challenging. I mean, glioblastoma is so difficult to treat.
So it's not just to make people more comfortable while they're undergoing arduous therapy and, you know, keep them happier and make them less depressed. That the notion is that it can actually affect outcomes.
Absolutely. It changes the brain chemistry in such a way where the medication will be more effective. I mean, obviously she's still preliminary in her research, you know, because I was asking, like, when is the app going to be out? When can clinicians use that in clinical practice? And she's not there yet. But the fact that she's determining that these integrative therapies like art therapy and music therapy can actually change brain chemistry in such a way that it can improve outcomes and it can help the patient respond better to conventional medicine. I mean, I think that's integrative medicine at its best, really.
Right. It reminds me a little bit of Mehmet Oz, who pioneered the use of Bach sonatas during cardiovascular surgery to create kind of a more harmonious atmosphere. Which is certainly good for the people doing the surgery, but may actually convey a subliminal healing message to the person, even if they're anesthetized. So
yeah,
kind of interesting.
Yeah. And the other gut access article that I did recently was for integrative practitioner. And that's actually, some of those articles are the ones that I loop you in for integrative practitioner, because you know, that also is for healthcare professionals. So I like to partner. And I found, I wanted to do an article on the gut-eye axis. And Dr. Hoffman, I have not even heard of the gut-eye axis.
Right. I got to admit that, you know, I think it's plausible, but I'm not sure mechanistically how that could be, how that's happening.
Oh, I'm telling you, the scientific literature, I mean, my expert, you know, he spoke about over 400 papers published. Wow. Just on this one subject. And I, of course, you know, I double checked and I find, I found all kinds of stuff. But
with conditions like macular degeneration, glaucoma, potentially cataracts. I mean,
Anything inflammatory. But even just eye health in general, you know, like astigmatism and, you know, farsightedness, nearsightedness, but more so with like dry eye syndrome and some of these other, like you mentioned, glaucoma and some of these other things. So the premise is the same. A dysbiotic gut creates chronic inflammation, and that chronic inflammation can go to different parts of the body, especially when there's sensitive tissue. And if you think of the eye and the sensitive tissue in the eye, so I think that this whole gut axis thing is, I mean, we're just blowing that wide open. And I think that this really lends itself well to integrative medicine for sure.
And I was really pleased to hear interviews with Dr. Marty McCary, who is a, you know, very well-respected surgeon at Johns Hopkins. Who now heads a research group on how to improve outcomes in medicine. And he's recently written a book called Groupthink in Medicine. The idea that we, and it, he's just been reviewed in the New York Times. He was on WABC radio, or it's like a national radio program in New York. And he was interviewed by Peter Attia. And a more conventionally trained guy, you know, with well-burnished credentials you could not imagine. But what he laments is that we aren't paying attention to issues like the microbiome. He's a big microbiome guy. And he points out that, you know, for example, we tend to do all too many C-sections in this country as a matter of caution and safety. You know, you're high risk, so we're going to do a C-section. But sometimes it's just simply a matter of convenience. And sometimes, you know, potentially as an income producer, because it's, you know, natural childbirth is cheaper than an operation when it comes to medical billing. And he says, as a result of that, there's all kinds of consequences, because going through the vaginal canal, there's a seeding, because in the, you know, when you're in the amniotic fluid, it's sterile, but when you go through the vaginal canal, you get seeding of the gastrointestinal tract of the immature baby, and that's part of the priming of their immune system. Well, when you pop out of an incision, all you get is hospital bacteria, you know, and that may change outcomes in a lot of ways. And so here's a guy, you know, very mainstream guy, who is sometimes critical of the groupthink in medicine. Pointing out that, you know, through simple interventions, we can really improve health outcomes.
Yeah, I think it's similar to people who feel that we've become too sterile with our, you know, washing our hands and you know, not being exposed to dirt and, you know, and germs are bad. And you know, I grew up on a, you know, in the country with dirty animals all over the place, and I rolled with them. You know what I mean? So I think that there's something to be said for having us be exposed to a wide variety of microbes. And I would agree about the C-section and vaginal birth being so much more preferred for the baby. So I think that there's. And I think we're going to find out more about that. You know, this microbiome stuff, you know, I think we're just scratching the surface, to some degree. with the microbiome and its far-reaching effects.
So what else could people look forward to? What are you collaborating on, and what will appear in a future podcast or a future article in NMJ, Natural Medical Journal?
Well, you know, for the next, I have a podcast coming out on empathy. And this is interesting, Dr. Hoffman, because you might think, because you strike me as a very empathetic doctor. And you might think, well, that's kind of a duh. Shouldn't that be a part of healthcare? Well, I wanted to find out. And I also wanted to find out, like, what does it matter if the patient gets an empathetic doctor versus a non-empathetic doctor? Mm-hmm. Well, according to the research, I mean, it's very robust. You know, empathy in healthcare improves outcomes, improves the patient experience, it improves compliance. And I interviewed a wonderful doctor. It's another colleague of Dr. Altshuler's, Dr. David Cannon. And what struck me, I mean, this is he's a regular MD, and he was an Army doc. And I was just curious to hear from him. He was so kind and genuine and spoke so eloquently about empathy. I mean, he's a mentor in the the Integrative Medicine Fellowship Program. So he mentors young docs.
And that's great. It's important that they get exposure to that, because too much is just straight academics, memorization, you know, being sort of a genius in regurgitating facts.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I asked him, I'm like, are you either empathetic or not empathetic, or can you learn?
It can be acquired. I mean, there's some people who have a little bit more, shall we say, predisposition to that, and mm-hmm. others less so.
Yeah.
But it's an acquired skill.
Yeah, absolutely.
I wonder what he had to say about the advent of chatbots replacing doctors, because, you know, can we make the chatbot more empathetic, or do we lose that quality altogether when we replace humans with algorithms?
Interesting. I didn't ask that question, but it would have been a good one. I mean, our focus for the interview was on the visit. And, you know, his point is, like, you know, in medicine, we have 15 minutes. And, you know, how do we, and he very much focuses on empathy before he even opens the door.
Yep.
He puts that the last patient aside, the charting that he just did, all that goes aside, and before he even opens the door, he says to himself, "How can I help this patient? And I want to be an active listener." And he goes in, he makes eye contact. Sometimes he'll touch.
I was just
going to
mention that is that the current setup for medicine with EMRs, electronic medical records, forces the doctor to stare into a monitor and type away while, you know, eliciting answers from a patient. And that really interrupts the direct contact, which I think is very much the essence of medicine.
Right. Yeah, so, absolutely. Yeah. And he also talked about being an empathetic doctor when the patient is angry, when the patient is frustrated, you know, which is hard, you know, that this mm-hmm. patient is angry, they're frustrated, they're upset, they're, you know, and just like bearing witness. I mean, you doctors are seeing people at their most vulnerable. You have to oftentimes deliver some bad information, and, you know, and doing that with empathy and care and compassion. It was a really good interview. It was actually better than I had expected, which was great. And I love that when that happens.
I have to say that many doctors are extraordinarily empathetic, and, you know, you got to have a little bit that affinity to enter, you know, a field where patient contact is so central. But I have to say, I hear so many horror stories of patients saying, you know, I went to the doctor and the doctor said, you know, it's likely you have cancer. We're going to do a biopsy. We'll let you know in kind of a cold fashion, and then, you know, leave them without answering any questions, you know, out the door. And then calling up and leaving a message on their voicemail. Yes, the biopsy was positive. We're going to make an appointment with you, with the oncologist. You know, that's it. It's a straightforward transaction because, you know, it is what it is, but there's so many better ways to handle a situation like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've had unempathetic doctors as a patient. I remember when I was first diagnosed with alopecia as a newly bald woman. I mean, granted, I was in my 50s and that was rare. And the doctor, it was a woman dermatologist. I'll never forget her. I never went back to her. And she said, well, you know, you just got to get over it. It could be worse. You could be a lot younger. And that was her answer to me. And I'm like, I don't know. I think being bald is, you know.
Well, this actually brings up an issue. And I, you know, I have an observation and, you know, it may sound vaguely sexist, but I have to say that women on the whole are more empathetic than men. I think that this is more of a female trait. On the other hand, going through the process of medical training tends to drive out virtually all vestiges of the natural feminine empathy that women have. And then sometimes women, in order to be proficient in a highly male-dominated field, less so now, but in a, you know, basically a testosterone-laden field, which is highly technical, sometimes eschew all their empathy and intuitiveness, and they can actually be worse than some of the men. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, that's been my observation. Look, it can't generalize, but it happens.
Well, it's funny because Dr. Cannon brought it up, and he said that in his experience, women are far more empathetic than men. But it is curious, like, does the process of medicine, of becoming a doctor, somehow drain that from women as well as men? And I'm hoping not.
Yeah. Well, you know, men may start at a lower level anyway.
Yes. Yeah.
It's less noticeable, the damage that medical indoctrination wreaks on them, you know.
Yeah. Could be.
Yeah. So anyway, so it's some interesting projects. So let's give people a heads up, you know, and especially some of the health practitioners who listen, because if you're interested in this type of medicine, you know, a lot of people's calling you and say, how do I learn about this? Oh, I know what I wanted to ask you. This is what I wanted to ask you. Is I talk, and it's less so now, but, you know, in years past, I've talked to some of my medical colleagues and they've said, you know, I do integrative medicine and, you know, I talk about vitamins and supplements and herbs. And they go, you know, if it really worked, there would be scientific articles and medical journal articles about it. And I go, wait a minute. There are literally hundreds of thousands of articles. So what do you say to that criticism of integrative medicine?
Well, it's a myth. You know, that there are no, and there are even gold standard, you know, there are double blind placebo controlled randomized clinical trials.
It's a little harder to study like a multifactorial lifestyle thing, like, you know, like the Dean Orner study where they do, you know, meditation and diet and exercise and, you know, social contact. And then they demonstrated that it helped to slow the progression towards cardiovascular disease or slow the progression towards dementia. It's multifactorial. So it's like, no, what was it? Was it this? Was it that? You know, medicine tends to look laser-like at one intervention.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's the challenge, because they will say, well, which intervention? And but no, I mean, I've been reading the literature for 30 years now, and it has grown exponentially. There's not a week that goes by where I don't find some new exciting study. I even so Dr. Altshuler is in charge of the abstract and commentary section of the Natural Medicine Journal, which actually clinically reviews studies. It's all about the studies. Right. So I will feed her studies that I find that I'm not going to write about. There's no shortage. It's a myth. You know, there is some great research going on. I think there is less of that Dean Ornish type research because the medical research establishment still isn't there to embrace a holistic approach. They want to know which intervention, and they want to research on that intervention so that they can say, okay, it was the meditation. Yep. That's what did it. You know, so I think but I don't mind that. I like the targeted research because what I do as a patient, as a person, is I combine them. So I'm like, oh, well, meditation is going to work for this for me. And the Mediterranean diet is going to work for this. And I'm going to take berberine for this, and et cetera, et cetera. So I don't mind the research being isolated or laser focused like that, where some people aren't as fond of that approach.
Right. in effect, what we're trying to do is we're trying to beat them at their own game. If they establish those are the ground rules, we'll provide the studies. Okay.
Yep.
We can do it too.
Yeah, very true.
Good. All right, great. Look, I have tremendous respect for you as a medical journalist because, you know, you have an open mind. You know, you also have a certain degree of skepticism. If a study sounds cockamamie to you, you know, you'll call it out. And that's the approach that I take with intelligent medicine. So I enjoy our collaboration. The NMJ is a great resource, Natural Medicine Journal. How do people find it?
Naturalmedicinejournal.com. There's a resource tab where you can find the podcast there. And then Integrative Practitioner is another great resource, and that's integrativepractitioner.com. So naturalmedicinejournal.com and integrativepractitioner.com.
Does it cost an arm and a leg, or is it, you know, attainable?
It's open access.
Oh,
both of them are open access. Yep. There's
okay,
no cost whatsoever. Yep.
Because you have a sponsorship model, as
exactly.
I do. You're underwritten by you know, good quality sponsors, and that makes it a free resource.
Yes.
Fantastic.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you can find information on the podcast that I do with Dr. Al Schuller at iThriveplan.com. Mm-hmm. And then if you search The Healing Factor, Carolyn Gazella, you'll find my Psychology Today column.
Okay. And it's Carolyn with a K, A-A-R-O-L-Y-N, Gazella. I'll spell it out, G-A-Z-E-L-L-A. Google that and you'll get all the resources that you need around this.
Yep.
Thanks, Carolyn, for joining us. And I'll join you soon because I think I'm due for a podcast with you.
You are,
sometime,
yes.
later this month or next month. I'm not even sure when, but
it's coming up.
Pop up on my schedule.
Yeah.
I look forward to
so
our
much.
Continuing discussions. Thanks so much for joining us.
I'm
Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I want to thank you for listening to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or your favorite podcast app, and get new episodes automatically downloaded every weekday. And please give us a rating and review. It truly helps new people discover intelligent medicine. The Intelligent Medicine Podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine, nursing, or other professional healthcare services, including the giving of medical advice, and no doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of information on this podcast or materials linked from this podcast is at the user's own risk. The content of this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should not disregard or delay in obtaining medical advice for any medical condition they may have and should seek the assistance of their healthcare professionals for any such conditions. Finally, please visit drhoffman.com and discover everything intelligent medicine has to offer, including frequently updated, unbiased health news, and fully vetted product and supplement recommendations.